Parshas Bamidbar, Bamidbar, first parsha of Chumash Bamidbar, also known as Chumash HaPakudim. In English, in the Western tradition, they call it the Book of Numbers. We really call it that too. Besides Bamidbar, we call it Chumash HaPakudim, the Book of the Censuses, or of the Numbers, the Tallies. We have kind of bookended by the two great censuses, the first one in the beginning of the Chumash. They expected to go into Eretz Canaan. Things didn't go as planned with the Meraglim. Then at the end, later, in Parshas Pinchas, Parshas Maaseh, we have the second census. The Sfarno, Rav Avadia Sfarno, picks up on an interesting, subtle difference in the language between the Torah's commands for the two censuses. The first one, here in our parsha, it says, B'mitzpar Shemos. The census wasn't just an anonymous tally. Everyone submitted their names to Moshe. See, they didn't just have numbers, they had a list of names too. Later, in Parshas Pinchas, where it gives the command for the second census, it does not use the same language. Does not say b'mispar shemos. They still took a numerical tally, but they didn't take the names. The Sfarno interprets this to mean the names somehow were more special or more significant in the first census because of these great personalities. L'ma'alasam, he says, that these names were particularly significant. The later names were just generic names, kind of the way we use the names today. Doesn't explain exactly what he means, how these names had their significance, in what way they were significant exactly. But the Sfarno, kind of by free association, reminds me of another Sfarno, which always stuck in my head. Someone showed me many years ago. The Sfarno has another comment about names back in Parshas Vayetze. He's going on the names of Yaakov's sons, Reuven, Shimon, Levi, Yehuda. So on the name Yehuda, he comments, these were not original names, as we might sometimes think, that were constructed by the mothers of the children. These were names that were in use in that culture, in that society. He brings an example. Yehuda was called Yehuda, but earlier we find one of Esav's wives was named Yehudas, Bas Be'eri. He gives another example, not with the Shvatim, but he says, we have Shmuel ben Amihud, appears in Chumash B'Midbar, but later we have Shmuel Hanavi. So just as today, names are reused. Not everyone got their own name, even though most biblical figures, we only know one person by that name, but not all. There are duplicates, and there are those whose names appear multiple times. The idea was that just as today, the names are... popular names are used over and over. Back then, too, even when the Bible tells us that someone gave a name, Leah called her children Ra Hashem Ba'ani, and Shama Hashem, and Hapam Yilav Ve'ishi, and Yehuda, Hapam, she gives Hodah to Hashem, even though they had reasons for picking those names, based on their personal situations, on their personal circumstances, nevertheless, the names were not original. He says, "How you bochrim as shemos hakodmim?" They would pick earlier names, the ones that were appropriate for their situation, much as people do today. They pick names either commonly after an ancestor, and also because the names represent a religious feeling, a personal feeling, a feeling of joy commonly about a child, or so on. So, the Sfarno, on the one hand, some of the names, at least in this parasha in B'Midbar, he says, did have something to do with the personalities, either divine inspiration or some other. Procedure. But on the other hand, he says, in general, the names were often chosen based on the circumstances in which the namers found themselves. I want to talk a little bit about names in the Jewish tradition, kind of free association, but Midbar is always a very hard pasha for me, but I want to just use this as a springboard to talk about this question, about some of the questions about Jewish names. The most interesting question to me is the question of, is there such a thing as a Jewish name? You know, what does Judaism feel about the using Jewish names as opposed to non-Jewish general names, Western names, and so on? So I want to begin discussing the name Esther a little bit. Esther, we know, had two names. Esther was called Hadassah, and she was also called Esther. The Pasuk says, "Vayhi Omein Es Hadassah, he Esther." She was called both Hadassah and Esther. Incidentally, The one area of halacha, which we'll touch on a little bit later, where the most actual halacha about names appears, real hardcore halacha, rigorous halacha, is in the laws of Gittin, where the laws of the orthography of names and how we spell them and how we write them and so on are incredibly complex and detailed set of rules. But one comment that always struck me as interesting was a comment by Rabbi Ephraim Zalman Margolis about 200 years ago. He says, in a note to his work on Shemos Gittin, he says that historically Jews did not have multiple names. When they did, they were alternate. Moshe maybe had 10 names, but he wasn't called by all of them one after another. He was called one or the other. The modern idea that people are named Avram Yitzchak Yaakov or Baruch Shmuel or so on is relatively recent, he says. In his time, it was fairly new. Even when people often give another name when someone's sick, they add Chaim or Yosef. Today, we speak about adding a name. We add Chaim or we add Yosef. That was not the way it was historically done. Historically, it was Shinui Hashem. They changed a name. They dropped the old name. They added a new name. Somewhere around two or three centuries ago, the custom evolved that now people have multiple names from birth, and they're often called by both, even if not on a daily basis. When they're called to the Torah, they're commonly called by all their names, not just one or the other. When they add a name, it's adding. We have Chaim Yosef, or we add Chaim Avram or something. We don't just replace the name. This is a relatively new innovation. But in any event, Esther, biblical Esther, she has two names. Again, alternate. She's not called Hadassah Esther. She's called either Hadassah or Esther, most commonly Esther. So the Talmud already discusses this. Why does Esther have two names? What was her real name, so to speak? Is one real and one some kind of nickname? So what is going on with Esther and Hadassah? So the Talmud offers several explanations. One of them is that her real name was Esther, and that Hadassah is a reference to Tzadikim. It's a kind of Midrashic reference. Tzadikim are called Hadassim. It's Tzidkaniyos in this context, Tzedekas. Another idea was her real name was Hadassah, and Esther is a reference to the fact that she knew how to keep a secret. Mordechai said, don't tell anyone about your antecedents, and she didn't. Misateres devareha. But most interesting and most perhaps provocative is the third suggestion of the Talmud Bavli in Megillah. The end of the first paragraph in number two, Rabbi Nechemiah says, Hadassah Shma. Her real Jewish name was Hadassah. Lama Nikris Esther. Why was she called Esther? Shayu Umos Ha'olam Karinos Al Shom Istahar. Because the non-Jews called her Esther, which was a reference to Istahar. What exactly is Istahar? Foreign word, obviously, but what is Istahar? So Rashi says the moon. The moon is sometimes called Sahar, Sihara in Aramaic. So Rashi says she was beautiful like the moon, common metaphor in poetry in later generations too, beautiful as the moon. All right, Istahar comes from Sahar. There is, however, another explanation, and this is, we're getting into really murky waters here. This is an idea that was proposed by Rav Yaakov Emden, who was something of a scholar. It also appears in the Targum Sheni on Megillah, an old Midrash on Megillah, some other sources that say that Istahar actually refers to Venus, the morning star. The Ivit says, Shem Kochav Noga, the bright star. Venus is a planet in today's terminology, of course, but back then it was called a star. Kochav Noga, the bright, sparkling star, morning star, evening star, Targum Sheni, same planet. Targum Sheni in Megillah says, Iskariyashma Esther, b'shem Kochav Noga. Esther was called by the name of the bright star, Venus, Yuvanis, Astira. Greek, it calls it, name was Astira. So Esther's name was A, the Talmud tells us, was a non-Jewish name, according to one of the three opinions, and B, she was named, according to some interpretations of the Talmud, she was named after Venus, after the morning star. This actually fits elsewhere. The Talmud famously says that Lamatech al Ayelas HaShachar, the psalm that talks about Ayelas HaShachar, is a reference to Esther. She was bright at the end of the Golos, like the morning star is bright at the end of the night. Different drushim. Ayelas HaShachar refers to Esther, another support for the idea that Esther was called Esther as a reference to Venus, the star or planet Venus, the morning star. Now, the curious thing is, yes, that's what I want to get to now. So Esther, especially if it's after Venus, sounds a whole lot like Ishtar. Ishtar was the Babylonian name for Venus, the goddess in the ancient pantheons. There was, you know, Venus is the god of love and beauty. The star was, I guess, a bright and attractive star. So Ishtar is a pagan name after a pagan deity. So none of the traditional Jewish sources make the actual connection to being named, as you're pointing out, after a deity. The closest they come is to acknowledging that the name was based on the morning star, based on Venus. None of them actually point out that Ishtar which sounds a lot like Esther, was may very well have been based on, again, the name was given to her by the non-Jews, so it's not like her pious Jewish parents called her that, but it is, if this is true, it is kind of odd or ironic that the name by which she has become immortalized could be the name of a pagan deity. That's a little disturbing, at least to me, but that this is strongly suggested by a number of the traditional sources who don't quite make the last leap to... Yes, so Mordechai, I'll mention that next. Mordechai, I did not find as much in traditional sources. Mechi's referring to the fact, I think, that Mordechai is often thought to be a version of Marduk, which was another ancient deity. So I don't have any traditional sources on that one, and there may be. I haven't come across them yet, so I don't know. But, you know, again, same idea. It is possible that these were names. And that's what I want to discuss in, you know, a little bit of a less sensational way, the idea that many of the traditional Jewish names, and some of them have even become today except their Jewish names may have had their origins in somewhat unusual places.
Let me argue. You are creating a problem, this problem, because you are learning this Gemara in a very restrictive way. The way that you're learning it is that the name that she's given, this name, because the previous reference either to the moon or to the Babylonian goddess, whatever it is. But you don't have to learn the Gemara like that, but rather the way that I learned this Gemara before is that now Chazal are doing a play on words and say, hey, you wouldn't know why we call her Esther, because, and they give this very fanciful,
I will certainly admit the Gemara is not conclusive in any of these ideas. Esther is an unclear term, even, you know, and certainly different ways. The Gemara does say Umos Ha'olam. The Gemara does say it was not just homiletics. The Gemara seems to be making a historical assertion that there were Umos Ha'olam, there were non-Jews. We can debate it. I agree. None of this is conclusive. I'm just pointing out that it's speculation, but it is speculation that has somewhat of a basis in traditional sources. It is speculative, yes. There are definitely other ways to understand what's going on here. Just want to quote an interesting comment before we move away from Esther, a comment of the Sefer Get Masudar. The Get Masudar was one of the great classics on Shemus Gittin, again, written about a century and a half ago. So one of the key dichotomies that we deal with in the laws of Gittin are we categorize names in a binary categorization. They're either considered Shem Kodesh or Shem Chol, holy names or non-holy names, ordinary secular names. There are a number of technical halachic differences for how we write them in the Get. We'll discuss some of them a little bit later. But one of the key questions always is identifying whether a name is Kodesh or Chol. Usually it's easy. You know, Sarah and Chanar, Yitzchak and Avram are obviously Shem Kodesh. They're in Tanakh. They're traditionally Jewish names. Some names are obviously Chol. You know, Howard or, you know, so on. A lot of names are, Howard is often a version of Chaim, but a lot of names are obviously not particularly Jewish names. Some names are a little bit ambiguous. So for either halachic questions or historical questions are a little bit ambiguous. So there was a great question about the name Alexander. We all know, obviously, Alexander came from the Greek. Historically, I don't think there's any real question that Alexander came from Alexander the Great, or it was a Greek name. The question is, halachically, should we treat Alexander as a Shem Kodesh or a Shem Chol? In other words, even though historically it did come from the Greek, but it became adopted and incorporated as a Jewish name very early on. The story goes back to Shimon HaTzadik, where he met Alexander, and it became a Jewish name already hundreds of years before the Churban, so more than, you know, close to 2.5 millennia ago. So the question is, how do we treat that? So the Gemara Masudar argues for the position that we should treat Alexander as a Shem Kodesh, which has certain ramifications. And he says, history doesn't matter. He says, once the name became incorporated and became assimilated to Jewish culture early enough on the time where they still had the Bible and the time where they still spoke Aramaic, he uses different criteria. He says it is considered a Jewish name. And the example, he says, is Esther. Esther, he says, he seems to follow that, depending on the Talmud, is not historically a Jewish name. Esther was a name that the pagans called Hadassah. Nevertheless, because it was early on, it became a Jewish name. It acquired the character of a Jewish name. It was in the Bible. It was in Talmudic times and so on. He says, so too, Alexander. It doesn't matter that initially it came from the non-Jews. Once the Jews adopted it early enough on, it became a venerable Jewish name. Chassidim use it a lot today, I think. It has the status of a Shem Kodesh. The way he describes Esther is, he says, kind of delicately, he says, Af Shem Esther lo nitzmach al admas Kodesh. It did not sprout from holy ground. It's Persian, he says. It came from Persian, and he takes for granted that's the Iker Pshan of the Gemara. You know, there are a lot of names that people have speculated where they come from, more recent names, but most of them we don't have, I think, absolutely conclusive scholarly evidence. One name that, you know, there's speculation about Sprints and Esperanza and so on, but one name which we do have at least a noted halachist expressing an opinion on is another very curious case of a possibly pagan origin. That is the name Fivel or Fivish. So Feivel and Feivish was an old Yiddish or an old German name. It, as the Beis Ephraim notes, the Beis Ephraim, Ephraim is Alan Margolis, a leading halachist of two centuries ago, his work on Gittin, Tiv Gittin, he discusses the name Feivish, and he gives the following interesting explanation for the etymology of Feivish. He says, Belashon Italia, in Italian he says, Laz Shel Shemesh is Fabias, or Phoebus. Now, as far I don't know Italian. As far as I know, I looked it up probably online somewhere. I think the word is sol or something is the way they actually call the sun. But Phoebus is the Greco-Roman god of the sun. He just says the Italian word for the sun is Phoebus or Fabias. That is the origin of the name Feivish, he says. And as proof, as corroboration of this, he says the name Feivish, Feivel or Feivish, historically went along with names that have to do with light or sun. Examples are Uri, Ur, Shraga, Shneir, and Shimshon. So Shraga Feivel was is a common name, Uri Shraga, and so on. He says it is used with other names too. He says you know how that happened. You know how sometimes people are called Feivish and something else? He says because sometimes there would be two parents and each wanted a different name. So what they did was they would give the Hebrew name of one of the ancestors and the Yiddish or German or whatever it was name of the other one. So that became Reuven Feivish or something. But in general, he says, Shamati. He doesn't say he knows this is true, but he heard it, and he seems to consider this a credible theory. Once again, he doesn't make the last step to the deity of the Greco-Roman god Phoebus. He, as far as he knows, it's just a name for sun in foreign language. So he gets you almost all the way there, that it's a name associated with light and sun. Doesn't quite acknowledge that it may have actually been a pagan god, but also another name which is of interesting and somewhat dubious origins, the name Feivish. So this is the basic question. We certainly have some names which have these very curious antecedents, but getting down to the basic question of what the Torah's view of non-Jewish names in general are, there was a very famous midrash, we probably have all heard it, that one of the great merits the Jews had in Egypt for which they merited to be redeemed from Egypt is that they did not change their names when they were in Egypt. Actually, the text of this medrash is that this is one of these cases where there's a kind of pseudo-medrash or a medrash with no clear source arises. There's a common formulation of the medrash that says there were three things they didn't change: Shmam, their names; Lashonam, their language; and Malbusham, their clothing. Scholars have noted, various people have noted, that there doesn't seem to be a real source for the midrash about Malbush. The other two appear in Midrashim, names and language, clothing, garments. Doesn't seem to be an actual Midrash, but the other two do appear in a variety of Midrashim, including Midrash Rabbah. The list is not always three, the list is sometimes four. I quoted one version of the Midrash here that says there were four things for which they merited to be redeemed from Egypt. One of them is names, they didn't change their names. One of them is languages, they didn't speak Lashon Hara, and they weren't guilty of immorality, Paritz Be'erva. The Midrash gives an example of Loshinu Eshman. It says Reuven and Shimon, they went down as Reuven and Shimon. They left Mitzrayim as Reuven and Shimon. They didn't call Yehuda Rufa. They didn't call Reuven Luliani. They didn't call Yosef Listim. They didn't call Binyamin Alexandri. Alexander was still considered a foreign name at that point. In any event, the Midrash gives them praise. It says there was a great schus that they had. They merited to go out of Egypt because they kept their traditional Jewish names. Again, Reuven and Shimon, as we said before, from the Sfarno, may not have been so historically Jewish. At that point, though, Reuven and Shimon apparently were Jewish names, and they didn't trade them in for modern cosmopolitan Egyptian names. Now, the problem is, this is not brought as a halach anywhere. This is not brought in Shulchan Aruch. This is not brought in any of the standard codes or formal halachic rules. And on the contrary, we have numerous sources that historically, from Talmudic times down through Gaonic times, medieval times, later times, Jews did, even without any question of assimilation or any question of pressure from the host society, there is a fair amount of evidence that Jews pretty commonly did use non-Jewish names, this midrash notwithstanding. The main source in the Talmud, besides, Rav Moshe Feinstein has a great tshuva, we'll return to it later, but Rav Moshe Feinstein has a very interesting tshuva where he brings many of these examples. One of the classic Talmudic discussions is, again, back in Hilchos Gittin. Here the question is not how to write the names of the participants, the husband and the wife. The question is how the Edom who signed their name, witnesses who signed on a get. So the question is a fairly technical one. It has to do with if we find a get and we have names, and they used to actually use the signatures as a means of verifying that the get was legitimate, the get was kosher. The question was, if we don't recognize the names, we don't know who these people are, can we assume they're Jews or not? So So the Talmud has an interesting question that arises: if the names do not seem Jewish, so what do we do? Can we assume they're Jews who just had non-Jewish names, or do we have to worry? Maybe this get is a problematic get that for some reason had non-Jew sign. There was no way to find out. Today we'd call up the issuing basement and find out, but you couldn't do that. So the question is, what kind of assumptions are you entitled to make if you find a get with non-Jewish, with pagan names on it? So the Gemara says, we had one example of a get with names of Lucas and Lewis on it, and we said it was kosher. The Gemara discusses, you know, different angles on this question. I'm not going to get into the technical details. But in the course of its discussion, the Gemara makes a striking statement. The Gemara says, Rov Yisrael Shebechutz La'aretz. The Gemara makes a sweeping demographic assertion. Most Jews who live in the diaspora, who live outside Israel, Shmosein Kishemos Ovdei Kochavim. Their names are like the names of the idol worshippers, meaning they do not have traditionally Jewish names. Most Jews in Chutz La'aretz have non-Jewish names. That is quite likely the case today, certainly if we count the non-observant, and even if we count the observant. Many of us, many observant Jews, very likely, depending on how broadly you define observant, but in all likelihood, outside Eretz Yisrael, is certainly many, if not most, Jews do have American, Western, you know, whatever the host culture is, names. So the Talmud already acknowledges this, and the Talmud acknowledges that names were commonly non-Jewish outside Eretz Yisrael. Additionally, Rav Moshe Feinstein points out many names in the Talmud are pretty clearly not Jewish names. Names of the Amoraim, the great sages of the Talmud, are pretty clearly not Jewish. Mar Zutra, Zutra, Papa, Rav Papa, Mar Kshishin, Mar Yinuka. He says some of those might be Aramaic. Aramaic might have a special status. It's a holy language in some ways. But in general, he says there are many examples, even in the Talmud, of names that do not appear Jewish.
Even that Medrash, which says that they kept their names, it's Rav Huna and Bar Kokhra.
Good point. Huna may even be one of Ramosha's examples of a name that doesn't sound, I don't remember for sure, but yeah, Huna does not sound like a traditional Jewish name either.
Don't you feel it's all so funny because we're assuming that the daughter of Paro spoke Hebrew when she named Moshe Rabbeinu?
So there is an interesting discussion about that, about how Moshe would have, if she didn't know Hebrew, how did that come from? There are those who understand, I didn't look up the sources on that, there are those who understand she actually named him some Egyptian word, which meant Mishisihu, and the Torah translates that for us into Moshe. If not, then right, then the question is how she would have known Hebrew.
You know, I wanted to say, most of the academics from scholarship on this point is that Moshe was a common Egyptian.
Uh-huh. Okay. Yep. So, as we're going to see, the pretty strong consensus outside post-Kumhur writing, just to kind of cut to the end for a moment, there's something of a consensus that among this, aside from those who said, based on Ramosha's arguments, other post-Kumhur have agreed to this, that Mikra Din, there is no problem with using the names of non-Jews. One of the first serious halakhic discussions about this, putting aside some Gittin questions, which we'll return to momentarily, is a fascinating tshuva of the Marashdam. Marashdam was Rabbi Shmuel di Medina, a leading Sephardic posek in Turkey, in Salonika. Back then it was Turkey, the Ottoman Empire. In the mid to late 16th century, it's important when you go through all these tshuvas, as we'll see, to consider who the authors were. So the Marashdam was writing at a time, the turmoil after the expulsion, the Inquisition, where the Sephardim had been displaced from many of the traditional countries, Spain, Portugal, and they had been expelled, fled, and so on to other countries, typically Islamic countries, the Ottoman Empire in Europe, North Africa, the Maghreb, as they call it, or the Near East, Iraq, Syria, and so on. And we find a whole body of literature, fascinating tshuvas that dealt with questions that arose out of all this turmoil and demographic turmoil and so on. So the Marashdam was asked an interesting question that also arose out of this. There were Jews, I meant to reproduce the tshuva here, it got left out, but there were Jews, Anusim calls them, conversos, who had shmadid, who had become Christians under pressure back in Spain. They had done the right, Portugal in this case, actually, they had done the right thing. They had gotten out when they could. They had happily reverted to Judaism. And when they had been Christians, when they had converted to Christianity, however, whether it was forced or not, they had adopted Christian names, as everyone did. When they went back to being Jews, back in Turkey, they reverted to their Jewish names. The question was, they had contacts, they had connections back, either family, personal connections, or business connections back with their associates in Portugal. and it would be easier, I guess, more practical for them to communicate with them using the names in which they had, by which they had been known back when they were Christians in Portugal. They asked, is that the right thing to do? Given that we've made a break with our Christian past, can we still use our Christian names? So the Marashdam says, certainly, Midas Chasidus, you want to do the right thing. Ideally, it would be good for you to use your Jewish names to reject any connection with your Christian past. He has a delicious rabbinic idiom. He says that, you know, Befrat, it's, you know, inappropriate, if it can be avoided, to use the name that was given to them, Ba'avram Aleihem Hamayim Hazedonim, when the evil water is passed over their heads. The baptismal font, he means that you should avoid as much as you can any connection to that. However, he says, Mikra Din, there is no question, despite the Midrash that says that Lashinu Hashemam, Mikra Din, it is not a halacha concern. Midas Chasidus, but it's not a halacha requirement. And as examples, he brings that discussion in the Talmud and Gittin we mentioned, that we know historically Jews did have non-Jewish names. The Talmud just mentions it without passing in any judgment on it, without any comment. Therefore, la halacha, he says, there is no question that if they need to, they can feel free to use non-Jewish names. Now, the other major discussion of the topic arises, the most robust discussion arises in the context of the laws of Gittin, and the discussion really all goes back to a very curious comment of Rabbeinu Tam. Rabbeinu Tam, Rabbeinu Yaakov Tam, one of the leading Balei Tosfos in Christian Europe, in medieval Europe, he was asked a question about a get. He was asked about a mumar, an apostate. The implication is that this was an apostate, not someone who was forced to become Christian, probably someone who chose apostasy. So an apostate was giving a get. They often didn't want to, but either he was just a decent fellow, or as often happened, they paid him, or they prevailed him to give a get to free his wife, who was still an observant Jew. So they had to know how to write his name in the get. Now, this person had a Jewish name when he was Jewish. When he had passed under the Mayim HaZedonim, when he had become a Christian, he had been given a Christian name. So the question is, what name to write in the get? Now, normally a person who has two names, you write both. But here, Rabbeinu Tam said, Rabbeinu Tam vehemently said, we should not write his Christian name. Heshiv Rabbeinu Tam, and number four, Chalila lahazkir shem Ovid Kachavim b'Toras Moshe v'Yisrael. Chas v'shalom, to write his idolatrous name in Toras Moshe v'Yisrael. It's a very curious expression, Toras Moshe v'Yisrael. The Chasam Sofer, cite later, says, you know, get is not Torah. Get is a legal document. It obviously has a lot of halachas attached to it, but a get is basically a civil document, Jewish civil law, not secular civil law. But a get is not, get has no kedusha. As far as I know, you can carry a get into the bathroom. You can, doesn't need geniza. So a get is not some kind of holy, it's not like you're giving him an aliyah to the Torah by his Christian name. And in particular, many poskim say that the Chasam Sofer says that in time it's hard to understand. The number one priority, basically the sine qua non of writing names in a get, is to identify precisely, accurately, unequivocally, as much as we can, who the people are that we're talking about. That's the purpose of names in general, and that's the purpose of names in a get. So why Rabbeinu Tam gets so religious about this is not clear, but this is Rabbeinu Tam's ruling, which is discussed at length by the later poskim, Chalila to write Shem Ovid Kachavim B'Taras Moshe V'Yisrael, you should not use the name that he adopted as a Christian in the get, you should only write his Jewish name.
No, because you could very well argue because what Rabbeinu Tam is thinking is that guy is not that person that he was before.
Well, you would want it to match the ketubah.
Yeah, that's what it
seems to be. Yeah. Whatever the Jewish name.
Yeah, so. We'll see a little bit more analysis of what Rabbeinu Tam actually meant. The ruling is very terse, but we'll see in a moment, what Rabbeinu Tam actually meant by this. So the one most extreme or most simple and straightforward, maybe not straightforward, the most simplistic perhaps interpretation of Rabbeinu Tam appears in a ruling by Rav Shlomo Kluger, one of the great 19th century Russian halachists. He was talking not about Shmad, he was talking about people who had remained Jews, who had retained their Jewish identity, but who had adopted, possibly for assimilative reasons, in Russia or Europe of the 19th century, had adopted non-Jewish names, at least for their daily social intercourse. So legal reasons, legal context, social context, they had adopted non-Jewish names to the extent that they had gotten rid of their Jewish names. So the question is, should those non-Jewish names be written in a get? Most poskim say they absolutely should, and that is the custom today. Today, in Gittin all the time, include multiple names. We'll discuss it a little more soon, but they almost all poskim agree that, again, the point of, like Chaim Sofer says, the point of the get is to clearly identify, unequivocally identify who we're talking about. So we routinely write things like Chaim, he was known as Howard, and so on, or Yitzchak, who's known as Irving, and so on. We do that all the time. But the Rav Shlomo Kluger was actually opposed to this. He said you should not write his non-Jewish name in a get, just as Rabbeinu Tam said that you should not write the name of an apostate in a get. So too, he says, you should not write Jews who have adopted foreign names, non-Jewish names, you should not include that name in the get, particularly, he says, because their motivation, he says, is to assimilate, even if they're not actually, he's not entirely clear whether the people he's talking about were actually throwing off the yoke of Torah and mitzvahs, so or just wanted to fit in better in modern society. But either way, he says their motive is assimilation, li damos legayim, to resemble the non-Jews. Chas lahazkir shemas alel beget. Heaven forfend, we should write such names in the get, only write the Shem Kodesh, and so on. He says he heard other people do write the names. Chas v'shalom, to do that, he says, li ten yad leposhim, to support, to aid and abet sinners, he says, who want to be like kechol hagayim, who want to resemble the gayim. That is absolutely wrong. As I mentioned, this is not the consensus. He is literally, I think, a das yachid here. Almost all, almost all the poskim strongly reject his position. One of the leading proponents of the other view was actually someone earlier than him, a little bit earlier, was the Chasam Sofer. Chasam Sofer's case was asked about an actual case, a woman whose name was Livia. Not exactly clear what that is. There is a name, Livia. I don't think that's what he was talking about. He was talking about a Hebrew or Yiddish name named Livia, spelled Lamed Beis Yud Aleph Hey. He says the people in his time, also out of assimilative tendencies, were adopting non-Jewish Western names, European names. Chasam Sofer is not very happy about this. He repeatedly uses language like Darchem Derech Ikesh. They have a twisted or crooked path that they reject their authentic Jewish names and they adopt non-Jewish names. This woman, he says, the name she adopted was Lenny. I don't know exactly what kind of European name it is. Lenny Riefenstahl was a German, I guess, so I'm not sure if this was a German name, Hungarian name, quite possibly German. So he says she had adopted a non-Jewish name. The question is, what should you write in the get? Chasam Sofer says it is trivial, it is obvious, not like Rav Shlomo Kluger, he says. It is absolutely trivial that you must write her non-Jewish name in the get. And he says a point, which is made by many other poskim too. He says this has nothing to do with Rabbeinu Tam's ruling. Rabbeinu Tam, who said that you do not use an apostate's name in a get, that's because the apostate's name symbolizes it memorializes the apostasy. That is the name that name commemorates his betrayal of Judaism, his casting off his identity as a Jew and becoming a Christian. That Rabbeinu Tam felt was unthinkable. He says, but this woman, it's an evus, he says, it's incorrect to want to assimilate, but at the end of the day, she hasn't said I'm not Jewish anymore. She still considers herself Jewish. She hasn't gotten baptized. Therefore, he says, there's no question such a name is legitimate. It's not desirable, he says, but there's no question it remains her name. As I mentioned earlier, even Rabbeinu Tam, he said, it's really hard to understand. Who cares if this name is her apostate name, would be her apostate name, but the fact is, that's her name. That's how people know her today. Even Rabbeinu Tam is hard to understand, but certainly this kind of extension of Rabbeinu Tam to say it applies to those who adopt non-Jewish names, even if they did so due to assimilative pressures, it does not matter, he says, that's her name. We might frown on this, we might not be happy with this, he says, but it is still a legitimate name. It must be written in a get. And as I said, that's the consensus of practically all the poskim.
What is that word,
gius? Gius is just a noun form of to be a non-Jew, as in her Gentilehood. Or. And this is the point made by the Sanzerov, the Devar Chaim, Chaim Halberstam, the Yeshua Yaakov, Rav Orenstein, and others. They all say that the concern of Rabbeinu Tam is simply with not acknowledging the name that she took at the baptismal font. It has nothing to do with a name that's simply a Western name, to the extent that the Yeshua Yaakov says that even if for some reason he would have adopted a Jewish name as his baptismal name, he would have switched from a name like Yaakov to Abraham or something, that would also be Asur, he says. Abraham could be as fine a Jewish name as you want. Doesn't matter. If that is the name that commemorates the baptism, it is treif, and we don't use it. Nothing to do with the name being non-Jewish as a name in and of itself. Again, a lot of these poskim didn't like the idea that they were using non-Jewish names, particularly if that was out of a motive of assimilation, but they tolerated it. Rav Moshe's tshuva, as I mentioned, Rav Moshe has a long, interesting tshuva, and he has a later tshuva. He followed up years later. Rav Moshe was asked in the initial tshuva about The common practice, of course, is that we name after ancestors, grandparents, parents, and so on. So the question was, there was a person who had non-Jewish ancestors, and not non-Jewish ancestors, he had Jewish ancestors with non-Jewish names, American names, whatever the case was. The person felt a little squeamish, he felt frum, he wanted to use Jewish names, and he asked Ramosha, Chazal say, Loshinu Eshmam, there's a great tzchus to have Jewish names. Should I honor my parents, honor my family, and use parents, grandparents, whatever it was, and use their non-Jewish names, or should I switch to Jewish names? Ramosha's answer was that you can and should use the non-Jewish names. That is kavod of the mishpacha, honor to the family. And now, in order to do that, Ramosha has to explain that using a non-Jewish name is not a big deal. So Ramosha makes the point we mentioned earlier. He quotes a lot of this literature, quotes the Talmudic discussions, he quotes the fact that in medieval period, he says, we know of many great rabbis, some great rabbis who had non-Jewish names. The two examples he gives are Moshe ben Maimon. Maimon, he says, is apparently not a Jewish name, probably Arabic of some sort. And the other example he gives is the Magen Mishnah. The Magen Mishnah we always refer to by the name of his sefer. Magen Mishnah, his name actually was Vidal. Vidal is a Latinate form meaning life. It might have been a version of Chaim of some sort, he says. He discusses that in his follow-up tshuva, but it is a European name, whether Spanish or French, some kind of Romance language, whatever. I'm not good with the terminology, but basically it's a Latinate form of some sort of life. It is not a Jewish name, he says. And we know they used to use, Ramosha mentions briefly, Arabic names. Many of them were, even rabbis were sometimes not traditional Jewish names. My favorite, which I discovered when I was learning Gittin, although again, my Sephardic friends look at me and I should be ashamed of my ignorance, but there were apparently great rabbis named Abdullah. I was a little surprised when I first learned this, but the Rav Yosef Chaim of Baghdad, the Ben Ishchai, his Rebbe, the author of the work Zivchei Tzedek, was named Abdullah Somech, Rabbi Abdullah Somech. Abdullah, of course, just means Abed Allah, servant of Allah, which is, of course, the Hebrew name Avadia means Eved Hashem, or the Yiddish Gottdiener means he who serves God, and in Arabic it's Abdullah. So Jews apparently used Abdullah. This comes up in Hilchos Gittin, where the question is whether you want to use two lamids or one lamid. In English we write two L's, so the question is, does Hebrew follow that convention or not? Do you follow the orthography of the non-Jewish spelling? And do you write, since the name is Ebed or Abed of Allah, do you write it as two words, Abed Allah? Do you write it as one name? But yeah, there were rabbis named Abdullah. There were rabbis of all kinds of Arabic and foreign names. Or Moshe points this out. He says, we know that Jews commonly had non-Jewish names, that this was a fact. Or Moshe theorizes, perhaps he says, he assumes when they first began to do this, probably was frowned upon by the Gedolim, but you know, they didn't succeed in blocking it. The names became entrenched. And as we said earlier, similar to what we said from the Gemma Sudar, once the names gained traction and they became accepted, at that point they became legitimized. At that point they become legitimate Jewish names. There's no longer any need to fight that, he says. Therefore, Moshe says there was no prohibition, there was nothing really wrong with using a non-Jewish name, and if it's honored to a deceased member of the family, Ashkenazim at least only give names after deceased people of the family, but whatever it is, if you're honoring the family, you should use the name. Ramosha points out, interestingly, that women in particular, even Ashkenazic cultures, even more than men, often didn't have Jewish names at all. The men commonly had both. If a man might have been known as Hersh, but he would have been Tzvi, he would have been called to the Torah as Tzvi. The women, he says, commonly only had Yiddish names or German names. Ramosha's correspondent had suggested, well, maybe the Yiddish names were most of these names were Yiddish in Ashkenazic culture. Maybe they were uniquely Jewish names that weren't used by the non-Jews. Ramosha says, you can't say Svaris to alter the facts. He says, there's no question these were simply vernacular names. Yiddish used to be simply the vernacular language, a version of the German spoken by the host culture. There's no question, he says, the names they chose were simply names that were either used by the non-Jews or had meaning in the non-Jewish language. Today, these names might have become exclusively Jewish because the host culture stopped speaking those languages or stopped speaking those dialects. But there's no question, he says, originally, don't tell me that these Yiddish names were Jewish names. They were simply host culture names. He assumes the rabbis would have protested initially, but it became accepted. Today, there was no longer any need to fight these names. These names are fine. What about the Midrash that says there was a great merit of the Mincha here is 8? Yeah. What about the Midrash that says it was...
Flowers are 8.
The flower program is 8.
What about the Midrash that says it was one of the great merits of the Jews that they were redeemed from Egypt? So first of all, he says, okay, it's a Midrash. It was a merit. It's a nice thing. It's good, he says, but not a halacha. It isn't established anywhere as a halacha. Then he has an additional speculation, which he admits is a very bold bit of speculation. He doesn't want to say it without what he calls raias gedolos, but he says perhaps before the Jews had the Torah, before they had mitzvahs, and even what they had, they didn't keep that well, halalo of devodah zarah, halalo of devodah zarah, before they had the Torah, which makes them a people, so the names are really important. One of the few things they had to distinguish them from the Egyptians were the names. After Matan Torah, we have Tariq mitzvahs, we have the Torah, he says. There are other more important things that distinguish us from the non-Jews, and that we no longer have the same need to be so concerned about the names. Okay, so that's speculative, he says. He doesn't want to really say that without proof. But in any event, Ramosha says, it's a matter of halacha. It's a matter of halacha. This is fine. There is no problem with having non-Jewish names, and therefore, certainly if it's a question of honoring one's family, honoring one's ancestors, one should use the non-Jewish names out of deference to the to one's family. Now, there were poskim, particularly in the Hasidic, in the Hungarian anti-Reform school, who were vehemently opposed to non-Jewish names. But again, as we said, the context, it always has to be acknowledged, they were writing largely in a specific time and place in the great battle against the Reform in the 19th century. So the Maram Shik, or Moshe Shik, a leading disciple of the Chasam Sofer and a leading anti-Reformer, has a tshuva vehemently arguing that if someone uses a non-Jewish name, he violates several biblical prohibitions. We discussed B'chukoseim lo telechu, walking in the ordinances of the non-Jews, va'avdil eschem mikol ha'amim, and Hashem says, I distinguish you from the non-Jews. He argues it's flat-out forbidden, and so on. But as I think I mentioned once or twice before, some later authorities have said, you really have to take that in context. He's really making a point, or you shouldn't take such things quite so literally. The Rav Asher Weiss, he's a chassid, he's pretty religiously conservative, but he says, the same rights that Moshe brings, there was no question as a matter of historical fact, Jews frequently did have non-Jewish names. You can't argue it's usher. So he says that he was writing at in the throes of the battle against the Reform, where the people doing it were their motive, and it was part of a broader program to assimilate and to reject Judaism. So he wrote that they're doing terrible things and they're violating biblical prohibitions. But in the abstract, objectively, without the particular historical and cultural context, Rav Asher Weiss says you cannot say that someone who does these things, someone who adopts a non-Jewish name, is actually violating a biblical prohibition. Similarly, the Debertziner, the Be'er Moshe, a fiery Hasidic posik from the middle of the last century, talks about how it's absolutely usher and it violates various biblical prohibitions. I don't know about the historical context that he was saying, and he might have felt it is actually a flat-out isser. I don't know what he would do with all the sources we've brought. What I actually found most puzzling about his tshuva is that the language he uses repeatedly is you have to use Shemos me'atanach and not foreign names from your host culture. He kind of eludes the fact that most of the names in his community, many names in his community, were Yiddish names, which are most certainly not Shemos me'atanach. So either what he really meant to say was he may have felt that Yiddish has become a Jewish language, even though they're not. He keeps focusing on Shemos me'atanach, so I don't know if he felt he really didn't like Yiddish names either, or he felt that the Yiddish somehow was special or different, I don't know. But in any event, he also writes, and the Hasidim in general are obviously going to be more strict, and they keep Lashinu Asmal Bushim also to some extent. But in general, at the end of the day, the bottom line is, many poskim, the consensus is it's probably a good idea to the extent that one can to use Jewish names, but from the Marash Dam down to Moshe Feinstein and to many poskim in between, they say it is not strictly usher, certainly if one is not motivated by an overt problematic assimilationist program, might be a good idea, but it's certainly not usher, and in a get, we certainly write these names, these European or American names.